From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
I'm Andrew Richards.
I'm Melanie Stevens.
And we have a guest today. Tell us a little bit about yourself and where you work at Microsoft.
So I'm the GC dev for the .NET framework. So, you know, I work on the garbage collector for .NET.
And we'll be hearing GC a lot today. That's garbage collection. Tell us a little bit about what garbage collection is for those who might not be familiar with it.
Garbage collection is basically an automatic memory manager. So a simple way to think of it is you allocate the memory as a user, and garbage collector will clean it up for you. So it'll find, you know, these objects are still alive, so I'm going to keep them, and these objects are dead, so I'm going to clean them up. So you don't have to worry about freeing the memory.
So what's the main reason that we went for a garbage collection model in .NET rather than the C++ way of doing it, where it's the responsibility of the programmer to worry about all memory allocations? What was what's the thinking behind it?
There are a few reasons. So number one reason would be for the memory safety. So you can't poke around in other people's memory, and that would be a security hole. Mm-hmm. Another reason is that I came from native world. I mean, I still work in native code pretty much most of the time because GC is written in C++. And I can tell you that people spend a ton of time tracking down memory corruptions. And I remember, you know, teams within Microsoft, they told me, like, you know, we spent most of our last release tracking down memory corruptions because native code, and that has been a huge burden. So using GC, it has lifted that burden for them.
I think there's still complexity, though. There's things like, you know, weak links and hard
links.
So do you think people still struggle with the concept of memory management, even though we've tried to simplify it for them?
So I think if you want to do a good job in perf, you know, if you want to have good memory performance, you always have to do performance work. There's never a way to get around that. But I think with the introduction of the GC, it just gives you a lot of freedom to free yourself up to do a bunch of other things, like to focus on your business logic instead of struggling with a bunch of heap corruptions and worrying about when do I free the memory or have I already freed it, I'm freeing it again, that kind of thing.
So I guess you could say that Microsoft's taking the responsibility for the fundamentals.
Exactly.
And letting you get on with the actual business productivity stuff.
Exactly. We want people to use .NET framework. You know, one of the biggest reasons is for productivity, right? And we've been hearing from people all the time that by using .NET, they've increased their productivity by manyfold.
Mm-hmm. And has that changed over the years? Like when .NET 1.0, I suppose, came out. When was that? That was back in
over 10 years ago.
Yeah, so has
13 years ago.
Have we kind of changed the way we look at garbage collection and its role within the CLI?
Oh, absolutely. So we change to sort of adapt to the new scenarios, the new ways people use memory over the years, mm-hmm. right? A few years ago, when people said, like, when I first started working on GC, it was very rare that somebody had a memory. Managed memory heap that was, say, 200 megs. Mm-hmm. And if you had something that was 200 megs, and other people would say, like, oh, what are you doing, right? But now I'm dealing with heaps that are, like, 20 gigs.
Yeah.
So that's a huge change. And we had to sort of reconsider things we've done before to make it work well for a new scenario, for the more powerful, more stressful scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what about the CPU numbers? Has CPU numbers changed the way we thought too, or
CPU changed less than the memory bus speed per se, because you know, as we know, the CPU hasn't been, you know, they've gone up, the speed has gone up faster than memory has.
But so, what about synchronization issues with
We've discovered bugs in GC that, you know, synchronization bugs that had been there since day one, but because of CPU speed, you know, they just hasn't gotten into the right timing for us to discover them, and that had happened rarely, but it had happened.
And how about scalability? Has the number of cores led to a linear scalability, or
yes.
We
always work on scalability. So, like, one of the things that we did was you can support more than 64 processors on mm-hmm. the machine now. So GC also in 4.5 we also introduced a new feature that lets you actually use more than 64 processors. Because, you know, if you are using server GC, you want to kind of scale to all processors,
mm-hmm.
and that was an important thing to do. So.
Actually, you just mentioned server GC. So originally we released MS Core Works, which WKS on the end stood for Workstation.
Mm-hmm.
Was there actually ever an MS Core server, SRV?
Yes, there was. It was in 1.1. And then in 2.0, we merged them all in one DLL. So there was only MS Core Works.dll.
So what was the original thinking behind that?
I think it was mostly just size concern. This was actually before I worked on GC. So I came in kind of late in 2.0. Mm-hmm. At that time, there was only one DLL again. So basically, we just compiled the GC source twice, one for workstation GC and one for server GC, and merged them into one module.
And the deployment package knew to put the right one onto each SKU of Windows? Is that how it worked?
No, actually, I think in 1.1, we just put both on all SKUs.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And now, since we only have one DLL, so of course they go everywhere.
Only one DLL.
Yeah.
And that was why it was renamed to CLR in 3.0?
Actually, personally, I don't know why it was renamed to CLR. Somebody renamed it. One day I just saw, like, oh, okay, there's no longer MS Core Works. There's CLR.dl. Okay.
But they're relatively the same concept, right?
Yeah, it's the same.
Cool. So when you do garbage collection in a program, a lot of things freeze, obviously, because memory's, you know,
moving around.
Yeah. So, you know, what type of considerations do developers need to do when, you know, be aware that, you know, you can pause execution mm-hmm. for a while? What type of things do developers have to be worried about?
So if you're using pure managed code, you generally don't have to worry about it mm-hmm. Because GC will take care of relocating, you know, kind of when we move stuff, we'll make sure that if you point to it, you also get moved. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's problems when you do, for example, interop with native code. So if you do pmoke, then you're responsible for making sure that the memory that your native code is using mm-hmm. does not get moved, because GC doesn't know about it.
Yes.
We can't move it for you. So a lot of heap corruption issues that we had seen before were related to pmoke. Mm-hmm. Of course, we have been trying to beef up our tools to help people catch those heap corruptions.
So what's the manifestation of a heap corruption? How would someone know out there that they're having GC heap corruption mm-hmm. and that's what's the cause of an issue? What are they going to see on the screen?
So if you don't do anything, your process will just terminate because you've hit an AV. Most of the time when you have a heap corruption, it'll show up as an access violation. Mm-hmm. Of course, heap corruption, because it's corrupted, it can really show up as anything. I've seen it shown up as a hand. For example, because, you know, you've corrupted something, we've gone, you made us go into a loop that just loops, you know, infinite loop.
Yep.
So, but most of the time, I would say it's an AV. So if you look at the process on the debugger, you would actually see mostly crash in GC code. Mm-hmm. If you look at the call stack, because GC is the one that walks the heap the most,
yep.
So it gets to discover there's a corruption sooner than most other components.
So what you're telling me is that don't blame the GC, it's probably not our fault?
Exactly, right. Most of the time it's not GC's fault.
Yeah. So I'm assuming, will the GC log, it will just be the responsibility of Windows Error Reporting to put an event log in the application log when it crashes, or has it got internal mechanisms to protect itself?
So we've made a bunch of tools available that help you catch the heap corruption earlier. Mm-hmm. Like, we have stress log that you can turn on, and you could get much closer to where the corruption actually happened. Because, you know, if you just let it happen naturally, very often a lot of things have already happened, and it's very hard to track down what happened when the actual issue occurred.
Mm-hmm.
So we've made some tools where you can turn something on in the runtime, it would make it show up a lot sooner.
So what are some of those tools, and where do you get them?
I think if you do a search, they're all available from MSDN, Microsoft.com.
But what are the tool names?
The stress log, I think if you just do a search for stress log, maybe stress log CLR,
yep.
You'll see explanation from MSDN, some blog posts and whatnot.
Yeah, we'll find that and put it in the show notes.
Yeah. And things like, there's a pinvoke, there's an environment variable you can set, where when you set it, we would do a lightweight check before and after pinvokes mm-hmm. happen. So that you can also get it from somewhere on MSDN. I can't remember that because it's a very long name. I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but it has something to do with pinvoke validation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So is that something that's safe to run in production? Are these tools heavy or are they?
Depending on which one you're using. So stress log could be very heavy.
Yeah.
Because, you know, some of the stress log settings say that, you know, we're going to do a GC before and after, or we're going to do a verification on the heap before and after a GC, and that obviously can take a long time.
Mm-hmm.
The PInvoke one is supposed to be very lightweight, so you can use that in production.
Cool.
Yeah.
So what's the major things that you think we need to tell people out there about the GC? What's the approaches and stuff to troubleshooting?
So I think rather than talking about troubleshooting GC, because that's actually my job, right?
Yeah.
People would actually troubleshoot your managed memory usage.
Mm-hmm.
So as with doing many other types of perf work, you want to kind of start early. You don't want to wait until the very last minute. I've had people who ask me, Maoni, can you help us look at this memory issue? We need to ship in 10 days.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, it makes it pretty hard to react at that point. So, you know, you want to do, if you want to do a good job at perf, you want to kind of measure early, right? You want to kind of compare and see if you have regressions from builds to builds, that kind of thing.
So really put it up front in your dev cycle. Don't
exactly.
Kind of wait for milestones.
Right. We have, you know, a lot of people that are using perf counters, and nowadays we recommend them to use ETW, which is a lot more accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And gives you a much richer information. So, you know, you want to incorporate those tools that are available to you in your, maybe, you know, daily perf run, and you want to kind of track down the perf regression as they come instead of, you know, waiting until very late.
So the main things are, I'm assuming, memory leaks,
mm-hmm.
Corruption. Is there mm-hmm. anything else that you're kind of looking out for?
Those are good things to start with, yeah. Memory yeah. leaks, definitely. And sometimes people, they just want to improve the performance. It's not necessarily a leak, but they say, like, well, you know, I have a bigger than what I want percent time in GC value, and mm-hmm. I want to lower that. That's what many people are trying to do.
So is that a matter of reducing the number of objects in the GC?
Reducing the number of objects in GC. It's mostly you need to figure out what is contributing to your percent time in GC, right? And that can come in different ways. You know, you could be, you could have a high value there because you're doing a lot of GCs, or you're doing GCs that just take a long time. So
mm-hmm.
that's something that I also like to talk about, exactly how you would do that.
Definitely.
Cool. Yeah.
Well, so that's, you got some demos or something you can show us?
Yeah, I was just going to show something fairly basic from the SOS debugger extension. So I got this Fragment-x86. It's just a little test that we use. It kind of simulates a very stressful server workload.
Mm-hmm.
So as the name suggests, it's going to fragment a lot. So when I do something in the debugger, you will see that it says it's going to be, it has a lot of fragmentation. That's by design.
Cool.
So I'm using WinDBG, Windows debugger package. And so we're using the Microsoft Public Symbol Server. And if we do, actually.
So what's that magic command you're typing?
That says, please stop when you load clr.dll.
Okay, so yeah. That's SX is setting the exception context, and then LD is the load module, and clr is the name of the module.
Yeah, so we've got clr.dll loaded. Now I can load SOS. So now SOS is loaded.
So we showed SOS loading in episode 14. We went through a whole sequence of, for this version of GC, .NET, you know, use MS CoreWorks for, what is it, 2.0 and below,
mm-hmm.
and CLR for 3.0 and above. And
right.
We also talked about Silverlight. Is there much difference between the way that you analyze CLR memory in Silverlight versus .NET programs, or is it roughly the same?
Roughly the same, I would say, because GC code is roughly the same everywhere.
Cool.
Yeah. So I got the SOS extension loaded, and we'll let it run a little bit so we can see what's happening. Actually, the JIT is loaded. We can do a CLRE heap-gc that just tells you where the memory is, essentially.
This is an SOS command.
Yes. So I wanted to just explain a little bit about the output of this command, because this is a very commonly used command. Like, practically everybody who uses SOS, they know this command,
mm-hmm.
Because it gives you such, you know, fundamental information about the GC heap. So as you know, we have three generations. We have Gen 0, Gen 1, Gen 2.
Do you want to do a quick explanation of why we have three gens?
Sure. So generational GC is actually a common trend in commercial GCs for a long time now. The concept behind it is that when you observe how people use memory, right, they allocate objects and they use objects, they tend to allocate either objects that stay there for a long time, like, for example, static objects that will stay until end of process, or they allocate something that's very temporary. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, if I'm handling a request or I'm, you know, drawing something on a page, and then after the page is gone, then all the memory can be released there. Mm-hmm. So instead of collecting the whole heap every time, it's not very efficient because you know that most of it will be static. Mm-hmm. They will not change, right? They will stay there. And so the generational GC idea says that let's collect only part of the heap, which consists of the temporary objects. So when we collect that part, we can be reasonably sure that we're productive because we'll get stuff back. Mm-hmm. If we keep collecting the older part of the heap, we're not going to get anything back because they're all alive.
Your return on your investment drops.
Exactly. Yeah.
So what happens to objects that exist in Gen 0 at the time of collection?
So those are called the Gen 0 survivors. So they will be promoted into Gen 1. And then if Gen 1 survives anything, they'll be promoted into Gen 2.
So they're not voted off the island, okay?
No.
So what's the cadence of these collections? How often does a 0, 1, and 2 happen?
So this is... this is controlled by the GC. So GC decides when it would trigger a collection, unless you trigger one yourself. Mm-hmm. This is mostly decided by your allocation and surviving patterns. So let's say, you know, you allocate a lot of memory and you survived a lot. So when we do a GC, we say like, oh, there's a lot that survived, so maybe we should wait a bit longer next time before we trigger the next GC. So when we do that GC, we can get relatively more space back. Mm-hmm. So that's mainly what controls the cadence of the collections.
But is it in the order of seconds, minutes, hours?
Again, that completely depends on how the process runs.
But when it starts, what do we start as? What's the initial
Initial value. So we set a bunch of values for the performance tuning parameters in GC. So this have, you know, these parameters have stuff to do with like how much memory you have on the machine or just basically the information on the physical machine, and we pick a good value that we think would be very optimal for running garbage collection. Cool. And then we tune it as we do each GC.
Cool.
Yeah. So since we have three generations, the output says, you know, Gen 0 starts here, Gen 1 starts here, and Gen 2 starts here. So at this point, you know, we just loaded CLR JIT, and we haven't really done any GCs at this point. We did allocate some objects, as you can see, because right now the GC heap is about a bit over 8K. Mm-hmm. And that's because the runtime, you know, the framework itself needs to allocate some managed objects on the heap.
So would these be the predefined ones for exceptions? Is that what they are?
They would. So let's take a look. So if I do dump heap stat, and there you go, there's an exception. There's stack overflow exception, out of memory exception, and thread abort exception.
So those three exceptions are pre-allocated.
Right.
Because in low memory conditions, we don't want
exactly
the inability not to allocate.
Right,
the thing
we want to use these exception objects as much as we can. I mean, there are still cases in CLR where you do need to allocate another copy because some, you know, abdomen or whatever other reasons. But most of the time, we just use a predefined one.
Cool.
Yeah. So, and you can also see that it says, you know, Gen 0 starts at, you know, this 10118 and 100C, that's where Gen 1 starts, and then this is where Gen 2 starts. So, to indicate that we have three generations, we have this thing called a generation start. So these are actually little objects that we allocate on the heap that would tell GC, you know, when we do a collection, we would know, oh, this is where Gen 0 start. Or at different phases of GC, it would say, this is where I should allocate the Gen 0 start to make the rest of the heap Gen 0. Mm-hmm. So these are what we call free objects. So if you have done some performance investigation, you notice that it says, you know, free, right? We have one here. We have four here, actually. So we got for free objects. So these are something that actually is made up by GC. GC makes it look sort of like an array object, but it's really just this thing that GC creates. It's unlike the objects that you create, right? Mm-hmm. So when you create something called system.out-of-memory-exception, it's a it's got a method table and the payload and all that.
Yep.
And GC, that's we allocate that because you've asked to allocate it, right? But as free objects, GC just allocates them because we need to allocate them so the heap is walkable or because we want to indicate something, like in this case.
Cool.
So now if I want to look at one of these free objects, I could do a do command, which is short for dump object. And I'm going to, actually, let me do this. Dump heap empty. So this is the method table of the free object.
Do you want to explain what a method table is?
Sure. Method table is something that is sort of like the type info. So it's a location to a piece of memory that where we store the type info for a class.
Mm-hmm.
This is loaded pretty early on, of course, because we need to allocate objects. We need to have it loaded before I allocate objects.
So if you're a C++ person, is it kind of analogous to an interface or a vtable?
It's sort of analogous to a vtable.
Or is it more like a structure?
It's more than the vtable, because we do need to store more information in order to describe the managed objects.
Mm-hmm.
So we got four there. So this one is the generation two start.
So the first one showed us all how many of each object there are.
Right.
And
so
the second command has shown us every instance
exactly
of that class.
So it says we got four here. So if I dump with the method table here, then I got four of those, as the output of eheapgc says. So now if we want to look at one of these, I'm going to do a do and do that. It just says free object, right? So if I want to look at one of the other ones, for example, let's say the out of memory exception object. All right, then, so we got one there, and this is the output of what an out of memory exception object looks like.
Mm-hmm. There's this attribute column, which might be a bit interesting to talk about. So sometimes you see instance, sometimes mm-hmm. you see shared, and mm-hmm. now sometimes I think it's static is the other one you see.
Mm-hmm.
Can you kind of explain what those three things mean and how they relate to the class?
So,
the object?
First of all, this column, actually, GC doesn't have any clue about it. So GC doesn't really care much about the type of your object. GC just knows there's an object there, and you ask me to allocate it, and it's of this size.
Mm-hmm.
So whether this is an instance or shared or static, GC has no idea.
It's just like an attribute of the class. It's kind of
exactly.
Right. It's still
that would be the type part of the system, not the memory part of the system.
Yeah.
So instance it's sort of like the C++ concept, the instance and static.
Yeah.
So really, what GC cares about when you tell it to do something with an object is just the what size this object is and what references this object contains.
Mm-hmm.
Because when GC goes and finds the children of this object, it needs to know where to locate those children. That's pretty much it. That's what GC needs from a type system in CLR.
Cool.
Yeah. So that's the that's what an object sort of looks like.
So we can see at the top, it took 84 bytes.
Yes, right. So it takes 84 bytes.
So we talked about the method table, which is like the definition of the class. What's mm-hmm. the EE class?
EE class is actually part of the method table as well. But EE class contains a bunch of stuff that's not as frequently used as what method table contains. Because method table gets referenced all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Because we sort of did a hot cold split. So we put really frequently used things in method table and then the not so frequently used things in EE class. So I wanted to talk about something that people, I've seen people do that when they do performance investigation that is not necessarily the most optimal way to do it. So often when people say like, hey, I want to know my managed memory usage, that's great. I think everybody should be curious and know what their memory usage is when they write an application, right?
So what are the tools for that?
So SOS is one of them.
Yeah.
So as we did the dump heap stat, you can see like here's how many bytes I've got on my heap. So at this point, we got this many bytes. Right?
Yeah.
So you know, as we run, you allocate more, and you'll see a bigger value there. We have a bunch of other tools. For example, one of the tools that we actually is authored by one of our people on CLRs, the Perfview tool. So it would give you a nice GUI format of the heap. It would say, like, here's, you know, the type X of this many instances, and gives you, like, how type, you know, those type of objects are references.
And is that something that you take a dump for and then look at it, or is it real time, or?
You take a memory snapshot and then look at it.
So you're, like, you attach the process and go, show me now.
Exactly, yeah, right.
So I know VMMAP shows the GC heaps amount, but it doesn't tell you what's inside that. It just says
because VMMAP is for a different purpose, right?
Yeah.
Perfview, that part of Perfview specifically says, you know, I want to show you your managed heap usage, right? VMMAP is more of a system tool, right? It's just internals, right?
Yeah.
So it cares more about the memory attributes. You know, it cares about, like, what part of your memory is reserved, what part of your memory is committed and is free, and what's in your working set. And that's a very important piece of information that actually VMMAP is one of a few that would actually show to you.
Yeah. And is the performance monitor counter is pretty good too?
So performance counters, that actually used to be basically the only way that people would use in their automated runs. Like if I have a perf lab, right? You know, I want to do runs on a regular basis. I want to measure a bunch of perf stuff to show to my developers.
Mm-hmm.
And performance counters were the way to go for that, right? Because SOS, I mean, it's more for a dev to go and debug something. You know, he goes on a debugger and type a bunch of SOS commands, right?
Yeah.
Some people did script that into their automated runs as well, but most people were using perf counters because, you know, that's kind of a major way that we shipped to indicate to you how much memory, you know, like how many GCs happened, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But since 4.0, we kind of officially said that, you know, we want to have people try out the ETW way because the ETW gives you much more accurate information.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the inherent limitation of perf counters is, you know, it's a sampling thing, right? So if I want to tell you, well, last GC happened, I show you this percent time in GC counter value, which is, say, 99%, because you did a Gen 2 GC, and during the sampling interval, it happened to be doing GCs 99% of the time, right?
Yeah.
But that counter value is not going to get updated until next time we do a GC. So if you happen to not do a GC for a while, then you would see, like, 99%, 99% for a long time.
Okay.
You would mistakenly think, like, oh, my GC time is really high, right? Whereas during that period of time, there's no GCs happening. Right, so you can, of course, correlate with other counter values and figure that out, but that's work.
Yeah.
Right. So we wanted to make something that's a lot more accurate and give people a better way to view the GC or memory heap usage.
Cool.
Yeah. So I was saying that often when I see people do managed memory performance work, they say, like, oh, I think I may have a memory problem. Let me go and measure my managed heap size, right? And the thing is, like, as we know that as we do GCs, GCs' job is to kind of shrink the heap, right? To reclaim space so you can allocate more on it. So when you actually do that measurement, actually can matter a lot. Imagine if you measure it right before a full GC, right? A Gen 2 GC. And this Gen 2 GC, let's say it reclaimed 400 megs, right?
Yeah.
And then if you next time if you measure, you happen to be measuring right after that Gen 2 GC, then you're like, oh, great, I just you know, dropped by 400 megs, and that actually isn't the case, right?
Yeah.
So I wanted to you know, sort of introduce this concept that, you know, when you do measurements for managed memory heap, you do want to consider when you measure. So, you know, you want to be consistent. You can say, you know, I want to always measure after a full GC, or I will always want to measure after a GC.
So instead of basing on a cadence,
right,
you're basing on an action instead.
Right. You sort of based on GC's cadence,
yeah,
if you would.
Yes.
Right. So.
And that's what ETW can do over performance counters, you're saying?
That's, so that part actually as much as I wanted to, we don't actually have tools that would very conveniently show you where that happens. Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing I'll show you today is what you can do with SOS or just under debugger.
Cool.
So there's a few years ago, I actually wrote an MSDN article called Investigating Managed Memory Issues. So this breakpoint I'm going to show you actually is from there. So I'm doing this all with public symbols, so you should be able to duplicate this on your machine. So I have condemned.
Condemned.
Yeah.
is it a zombie switch?
So this. Okay, so
you can see the two workstation versus server. Yeah.
Server, that's for server GC, and WKS, that's for workstation GC. So when I'm running with workstation GC right now because I'm not doing any special configuration.
So how do you configure that? Is that part of something you do in Visual Studio?
That's something you do in appconfig. So if I made a config file called fragment-x86-xe-config, yeah. And I put runtime, and then I say GC server enable equals true, that would enable server GC for this process.
Cool.
Yeah. So right now I'm not doing that, so I'm using workstation GC.
Yeah.
So the breakpoint I mentioned in that article was called, so this is restart EE. So we kind of talked about GC pausing your process to do a GC, right? And we'll talk about when GC will not do that. But mm-hmm. for now, for our discussion purpose, we can say when GC needs to do its work, it's going to pause the managed threads because we're going to move the objects around. We don't want managed threads to run mm-hmm. in that process. So then we have this suspension service in CLR that GC uses to say, I would like to suspend all the managed threads while I'm running. So it would go tell the suspension service that suspend, and then I'll go do my work, then restart.
So when a managed program, there's a separation of, there's threads that are intrinsically, you might want to call them native threads, mm-hmm. which run the business behind the scenes, mm-hmm. and then there's the threads that, as a developer, you've kind of developed yourself.
Right.
And so you're saying that the garbage collection knows that those ones are the user ones, suspends those threads, mm-hmm. and then all these worker threads.
GC actually doesn't know that. It relies on the suspension service to know that. Okay. Suspension service, this is actually a very commonly, a common misconception where people have suspension problem. They come to me and then I said, you got a suspension problem. I'll get our suspension dev, the threading dev to, work on that for you.
Okay.
So all GC does is calls these things called GC heap :: suspend EE, and then GC heap :: restart EE. That will do the magical suspend and resume process for GC.
So it's calling into a different feature set to achieve that.
Exactly. So the one I'm doing is restart EE. So the reason why I'm doing restart EE is when we suspend the EE, we actually don't know what generation of the collection we're going to do because we just suspend it, right? We have to go figure it out. When we restart EE, at that point, of course, we know which generation we have collected.
Gotcha.
So that's why, because I'm going to do something with the generation, that's why I'm doing it on restart EE. What this means is I'm going to be stopping right after GC has happened. So if I want to do,
conditional breakpoint. We haven't gone there yet.
Oh, okay.
That's great. Definitely do it.
All right. So I'm going to say two.
So for your C++ guys out there, conditional breakpoints is roughly the same syntax. You just put a dot in front of the if and a dot in front of the else. But the brackets are the same. You still use curly braces. You have to have the braces. And so it's if, round braces, round brackets, the or C++ type expression, then curly braces for the first, then dot else for the second bit.
This breakpoint says that restart E, if the we've done a Gen 2 GC, this says it's a Gen 2 GC, right? It's 2, and then we'll stop and dump the call stack. Otherwise, it will just go.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we'll let this run. And
so your program in the background is just making lots of objects and
right,
sort of stuff?
Exactly. Yeah. It says you're not using correct symbols. That's okay because for what we're the breakpoint we set here, the public symbols are enough.
Yeah.
So actually. So we got a call stack here that says, so you can see it says garbage collect generation. That's the entry point into a GC. So when we get here, because you know either allocation dictated us to trigger a GC or you've triggered a GC on your own, it would eventually get into this function called garbage collection generation.
So and the more spacing kind of gives it away that we were out of space at that point.
Right, exactly. So this guy will then call, you know, after it's done its work, it'll call restart E at this point. So we just did a Gen 2 GC, and now I can do my heap command again. So now we got, you know, 510 objects instead of a few before. So that's kind of a meaningful way to measure the managed heap size, if you want.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right, so we're kind of at half an hour. How about we leave it here?
Yeah, sounds good.
And we'll continue on and do more gooey, yummy SOS stuff.
Yeah, more next week. And if you have questions, go ahead and send those on to defragtools@microsoft.com. We're going to shoot the second show here today,
So
we won't have those for the next show, but we'll answer in the comments. See you next week.
Have a good week.
Bye.